This morning at Matthew chapter 22, verses 15 to 46. There's this Christian guy in the United States called Mark Lowry. He's mainly famous for writing the well-known song, Mary, Did You Know? And he does these shows which are part singing, part comedy, part reflections on the Christian life. They're probably not to everyone's taste, but he strikes me as a man who loves the Lord Jesus. And there's a clip from one of these shows where he talks about interruptions. And his main point is that sometimes in our lives, things happen which just seem like interruptions, things that stop us and delay us and divert us. And at the time, then, these experiences can be so frustrating. And yet often, Lowry argues, it turns out God was doing something important and special through the interruption. And in that connection, he mentions Jesus. And that time when Jesus was preaching in that house, and he has just reached the third point that Lowry imagines, and there are thuds overhead, and then bits of roof start falling on the listeners, and Jesus has to stop. He can't compete with this new claim on the congregation's attention. How annoying, how unfortunate, how untimely. But of course, you know what happens. A paralytic is lowered down in front of him. The incident gives rise not only to a great healing miracle, but also to one of Jesus' great statements. The Son of Man has authority on earth to forgive sins. And so Mark Lowry pithily concludes, the interruption made the Bible and the sermon didn't. And our passage this morning is mostly a series of interruptions. In the very last part of it, Jesus does seize back the initiative. But in verses 15 to 40, Jesus is, as it were, on the back foot, having to handle three separate interruptions. And these aren't like the one in that house in Capernaum. These are hostile interruptions. The middle one that comes from the Sadducees isn't explicitly flagged up by Matthew as being hostile. But he does tell us that the Sadducees don't believe in resurrection. And when, therefore, they ask Jesus here about what's going to happen at the resurrection, well, the question is unmistakably sardonic in its character. As for the two interruptions that come from the Pharisees, they're both covered by the opening verse of our passage. The Pharisees, remember, want to arrest Jesus. That's what we're told at the end of chapter 21, but they can't. And so they're trying instead to entangle him in his words, verse 15. So I'm saying that our passage is dominated by interruptions, and interruptions of a deeply hostile kind. You can imagine the disciples and others in the crowd as well, just wishing that Jesus could be left alone here and get on with some more parables or something. And we might read the passage rather wishing that too. But like the more famous one in Capernaum, these interruptions too made the Bible, to quote Mark Lowry. And this morning then, I want to talk about two things, and I'll spend longer on the first. First of all then, a worldview that's far-reaching. That's the first thing I want to think about. A worldview that's far-reaching. So despite the fact that the questions Jesus is asked here are insincere, Jesus answers them sincerely. He isn't evasive and uncooperative. He gives straight answers, which very helpfully actually express certain truths. And what strikes me is the diversity of these truths he expresses here. I remember hearing Jeff Thomas give a sermon illustration where he talked about a speed camera. I'm not entirely sure now what he was illustrating, but he talked about a speed camera, and he said that that camera could be positioned on the most scenic stretch of road in the United Kingdom, some really beautiful place. And yet it never takes photographs of sunsets and rainbows and carpets of bluebells, only cars, always cars, just car after car after car after car. And you get people like that camera, don't you, who just seem very blinkered and narrowly programmed. Politicians are the worst, of course. You get some government minister on the Today program on Radio 4, and clearly the one thing that he wants to say is that the government is investing more money than ever before in social housing. And you get the impression that Nick Robinson and Michelle Hussein could ask him anything, the name of his pet gerbil, the colour of his underpants, anything, and that would be the answer. The government is investing more money than ever before in social housing. Jesus isn't like that. As he faces the Pharisees and Sadducees' own Nick Robinsons and Michelle Husseins, he isn't monotonous and robotic and speed camera-like. His answers range across a rich landscape of truth, because you see, Christianity presents a worldview. Christianity isn't one simple conviction about God or salvation or marriage or something, and beyond that conviction, it has nothing more to say. No, Christianity is elaborate. That's why Christians are disciples. Disciple means learner. And Christians are disciples because in Christianity, there's a lot to learn. Doctrines and propositions and principles and concepts relating to all kinds of things. Christianity presents a worldview that's far-reaching. And let's look quickly then at the diverse snippets of that worldview that get touched on here in Jesus' responses. Three fascinating truths. Number one, godless authorities are valid. Godless authorities are valid. That's verses 15 to 22. Now, when it comes to the matter under discussion in these verses, it's perhaps hard for us to put ourselves in the shoes of a first century Jew. We're very accustomed to the idea of the church and the state being two separate things, and of the church therefore having to relate to the state in some way or other. But for the first century Jew, that was still a relatively new concept. Up until the Babylonian invasion and deportation, Israel had functioned as both church and state. On the one hand, Israel was God's special people, redeemed by him from Egypt, covenanted to him, the bearer of his truth in a world of idols. Israel was the church. But on the other hand, Israel was politically independent. Apart from God himself, there was no authority outside of Israel to which Israel had to submit. No external power setting laws that bound Israel. Israel was self-governing. Israel was a state. And that situation prevailed then until the middle of the first millennium BC. It was only then that things changed. Only then that this phenomenon began of Israel being under the rule of a human authority outside itself, a godless, pagan authority. And now, in the first century AD, this relatively recent phenomenon had hit a new level, of course. Apart from Antiochus Epiphanes' brief tyranny a couple of centuries earlier, the Romans were the most invasive and all-encompassing regime of any of the godless pagan authorities Israel had lived under. And so in a way then that we perhaps find hard to understand, this was a very live issue, I'm saying, for the first century Jew. How should we relate to the godless pagan authority that makes demands of us and seeks to regulate our lives? Should we ignore it? Should we resist it? Should we insist doggedly on the principle that God's people are answerable to no one except God himself? How should we regard it? And this is Jesus' answer, verse 21. Render to Caesar the things that are Caesar's. In other words, no, you don't ignore the godless pagan authority. You don't resist it. Godless authorities are valid. Caesar has the right to certain things from you, God's people, as much as from anyone else. That's what Jesus says. Now, this principle will be lent more nuance as the New Testament goes on. limits will be placed on Caesar's rights in relation to God's people. In fact, that's already hinted at here in the way that Jesus adds, and to God, the things that are God's. In other words, there are some things to which Caesar doesn't have the right. He doesn't have the right to your worship. He doesn't have the right to dictate your theological beliefs and convictions. Only God has those rights, and you must not allow Caesar to usurp them. So as I say, there's nuance already present here and elaborated later in the New Testament, but nonetheless, this is the basic principle, and you and I need to be clear on it. Caesar has the right to certain things from God's people as much as from anyone else. He has the right to our obedience. He has the right to our taxes. And that, of course, is the particular issue in view here. He has the right to our taxes, even though he's a godless pagan authority who will spend those taxes on some things that are abominable to us, like funding the abortion of babies and purchasing rainbow flags to fly outside council buildings to support the LGBT cause. Perhaps most challengingly, for some of us grim cynics, he has the right to our respect, our honor even. That's what Paul says in Romans 13:7. Politics in our land has become very toxic and uncivil in recent years. But as Christians, we must rise above that. We're entitled to have strong views about political issues just like everyone else does. But whether those strong views we have are winning the day or not, respect and honor for the current leadership are just non-negotiable duties for the Christian. And so that's the first truth Jesus touches on in this passage. Godless authorities are valid. Truth number two, future resurrection is real. Future resurrection is real. This is verses 23 to 33. Now, if the proposition godless authorities are valid is radical in a first century Jewish context, the proposition future resurrection is real is just radical, full stop. Intrinsically radical. Because remember what resurrection means. Resurrection doesn't mean something vague like life after death. Life after death is a bland concept that all kinds of people have believed in and do believe in. No, resurrection is much more than that. Resurrection means the restoration of physical, bodily existence. It means this skin, these bones, these organs being recovered from death. It's gobsmackingly radical. And that's the issue then in these verses. That's what the Sadducees deny, verse 23. And confronted with that denial here, Jesus is unequivocal. He affirms resurrection. Future resurrection, he says, is real. And I just want you to notice briefly that the belief then that future resurrection is real is underpinned by two more basic convictions. Conviction number one, God's power. God's power. Jesus says that a big part of the Sadducees' problem is that they don't know the power of God, verse 29. Now, it goes without saying, of course, that the whole concept of physical bodies long dead being restored to life, the whole concept depends rather significantly on the power of God. But there's something else going on as well here. Think of it this way. Imagine you really like a particular singer. And for years then, you collect that singer's albums and get really into the songs. And it's your dream that one day you might attend a concert. What an experience that will be. And eventually the opportunity comes and you buy a ticket and you're so excited. You count the days until the concert. The day arrives, you travel to the venue, you buy some merchandise, you have some food and drink, and then it's time at last for the concert itself. And it proves a huge disappointment. The arena is enormous. Your seat in the arena is as far back as it's possible to be. The singer you've come to see is just this tiny dot somewhere in the distance that seems utterly disconnected from you. And as you traipse out of that place at the end of the evening, then you reflect on the DVDs of that singer that you have at home and how much more enjoyment you've derived from those than from this concert you've just been at. You realize that you have to have the full-on concert experience for it to be great. You have to be near the front of the arena. You have to be near the stage. You have to be so much more connected and immersed in the whole experience. You realize that if you don't have the full-on concert experience, actually, no concert experience at all is better than a very limited concert experience like you just had. It would be better to forgo it altogether and watch the DVD on your sofa instead. And you see, resurrection is a bit like that. If resurrection is only very limited, then it's better not to experience it at all. And that's the kind of resurrection that the Sadducees envisage in their story in verses 25 to 28. Minimalistic resurrection. Resurrection that's nothing more than the resumption of physical existence exactly as it is now. And they're absolutely right then that that scenario throws up all sorts of messy absurdities like the one that they mention. A woman who has been married seven times, now with seven men, all thinking that she belongs to them. Later in the New Testament, the Corinthian Christians seem to envisage a similarly limited resurrection experience, and thus they too find the whole idea contemptible. And they too are right to do so. Watching that singer on a DVD at home is preferable to your lousy concert experience at the back of that vast arena. And having some kind of highly spiritual afterlife floating on clouds is preferable to a lousy resurrection experience that merely gives us back our old lives. And that's why the power of God is so important. Jesus is saying, if you Sadducees knew the power of God, you would realize that that power can give us a full-on resurrection experience, a resurrection experience beyond our wildest dreams, a resurrection experience that propels us into a new kind of existence where there won't be any of those messy absurdities of the kind you derive. A resurrection experience that in some respects will elevate us to the level of angels. You and I, similarly then, if we're going to have a credible, desirable concept of resurrection, need first of all a healthy conviction regarding the almighty power of God. If resurrection is minimal, then we'd be better off not having it at all. But the power of God means that resurrection can be full on, full blown, massive, propelling us into a new order of life. And then conviction number two, God's dignity, God's power, God's dignity. Jesus' point in verses 31 and 32 is often misunderstood. It has nothing to do with the intricacies of God using the present tense about his relationship with the patriarchs, even though he's talking to Moses and the patriarchs are by now long dead. No, the point is a simple one. The point is that God's pledge to his people, to the patriarchs and to all his people, God's pledge is this: I will be your God. That's his pledge. That's his commitment to his people. I will be your God. Back in 2013, when we were moving into our new church building and I was going to relocate my study there, my friend Andy in Thirst, some of you know him, said, I'll make shelves for your new study, and I accepted the offer. Now, suppose someone had said to me, "Look, Dan, it's a risky business, this. His shelves won't bear the weight of all those books of yours. They'll sag just like the ones from Argos do." Suppose someone had said that to me, I might have responded something like this. "If you think that my friend Andy is going to make shelves that will sag pathetically under the weight of my books, then you don't know my friend Andy. My friend Andy isn't the maker of saggy shelves. That would be beneath his dignity. He would be mortified. He would never be able to look me in the eye again. My friend Andy has said, I will make you shelves, and he will keep that commitment to the nth degree, not just throwing up a few strips of wood, but erecting firm supports for all my very weightiest tomes." And Jesus here is saying, if you think that God is going to leave his people's bodies rotting pathetically in their graves forever and ever and ever and ever, while only their souls manage to escape and survive, then you don't know God. God is not God of the dead, God of eternally rotting dead bodies, any more than Andy is the maker of saggy shells. That would be beneath God's dignity. He would be mortified throughout all eternity. He would never be able to look his people in the eye if he had done nothing to restore their bodies. God has said, I will be your God. And he will keep that commitment to the nth degree, not just salvaging our souls, but restoring us fully, soul and body. You and I, then, when conscious of hurtling towards death, and the thought is getting us down, we should go back to those five words, I will be your God, and realize the sheer scope of those words. God's dignity means he will do everything that those five words could possibly entail. And that includes one day raising our bodies from the grave. So those are two truths Jesus touches upon. Godless authorities are valid. Future resurrection is real. And then a third truth, God's law is serious. God's law is serious. This is verses 34 to 40. Remember how back in chapter 15, Jesus criticized the whole business of washing your hands before eating. I don't mean in a hygiene sense, that's a good thing to do, but in the being clean before God sense. And his criticism, do you remember, offended the Pharisees. In their minds, the actual commandments of God's law and all their elaborate applications of those commandments are kind of blurred into one, so that they doubtless construed Jesus' criticisms there as being against God's law itself. They probably suspected him now of being lax in his stance on God's law. You might meet another Christian, and you're trying to work out exactly where this other Christian is coming from. And so you ask him or her who their favorite Puritan is. And you're not really interested in whether they say John Owen or Thomas Goodwin or John Flavel or whoever. You're really just interested in whether they take the question seriously or whether it triggers a rant about how the Puritans are the worst thing that's ever happened to the Christian church. They're a bunch of joyless legalists who distorted the gospel of grace. That's what you want to ascertain. Will they take the question seriously or not? And I think it's the same here. When the Pharisees, through this particular lawyer who is one of them, when they ask in verse 36, "Teacher, what is the great commandment in the law?" I don't think they're probably particularly interested, actually, in which commandment Jesus goes for. Rather, they're interested in whether or not Jesus, the Jesus that they have suspicions about, whether or not he will take the question seriously, or whether he will now come up with some very disparaging remarks about the whole place of God's law. And he does take the question seriously. In fact, he takes the question more seriously than he needs to, you might say. He goes beyond the question itself and gives not only the greatest commandment, but the second greatest commandment as well, for good measure. Because God's law is serious. And for us, the reason we might be weak on that point isn't so much because of his criticisms of hand washing back in chapter 15, but rather we might have a confusion about the gospel itself, a confusion about what the bondage is from which the gospel delivers us and what the freedom is to which the gospel delivers us. Remember that description of the human heart in its natural fallen condition that we have in Romans 8 verse 7. It does not submit to God's law. God's law is good. It's good to love the Lord your God with all your heart and with all your soul and with all your mind. It's good to love your neighbor as yourself. God's law is good. The problem we human beings have is that we're so much in bondage to sin that we can't obey it. We can't submit to God's law. And when, therefore, Jesus delivers us from our bondage, we don't then say, oh, God's law is bad. We're done with God's law. God's law is a dirty word. We embrace God's law. Suddenly, for the first time, being able to live it out. That's freedom. Freedom is keeping God's law. Freedom is loving the Lord your God with all that you are and loving your neighbor as yourself. That's the free life. That's the emancipated life. Don't buy the secular idea that freedom is autonomy. Freedom is shaking off all law and all authority and all moral parameters. Don't look with envy at those who are trying to do that. Bask rather in the truest freedom that you have, which is living as your maker designed you to live. So Christianity is a worldview. Are you this morning a disciple? Not just a believer, a disciple, learning that worldview more and more, seeking to explore all its myriad truths. And for starters, are you clear on these three truths that Jesus touches on in this passage? Godless authorities are valid. Future resurrection is real. God's law is serious. A worldview that's far-reaching. But then secondly and very briefly, the worship that's fundamental. A worldview that's far-reaching, the worship that's fundamental. So, Jesus then, having responded to the three questions and having touched on these great truths that he has touched on, he would have gotten a lot of agreement from his listeners regarding those points. So the Pharisees, they would have agreed with his position on the authorities, on godless authorities. That's why when Jesus asked them for a denarius, they're able to produce a denarius, because they did carry currency around with them that had the Roman emperor's inscription and image on it. They didn't seek to resist and ignore the godless authorities. They were hoping, you see, that Jesus would take the opposite position. They were hoping that Jesus would say, resist them, hate Caesar, fight against Caesar. And then, of course, they would be able to go and betray him to Caesar. But the position Jesus does take on that matter, the Pharisees would have agreed with it. Also, of course, they would have agreed with him taking God's law seriously. The Sadducees, of course, they wouldn't have agreed with Jesus' answer about resurrection. But it's clear from verse 33 that the crowd as a whole liked his answer. The Pharisees, they would have liked his answer, because we know from elsewhere in the New Testament that the Pharisees did believe in resurrection. So I'm saying then that Jesus would have gotten a lot of agreement from this crowd for the points that he makes in this passage. As he expresses these different aspects of what we now call the Christian worldview, he would have had a lot of heads nodding in front of him. Are these people Christians then? No, enough. And that's the significance of the last part of the passage where Jesus takes the initiative. And really, I think what Jesus is saying there, here in these last few verses, verses 41 to 46, is this. He's saying, all these matters I've just expressed, all these truths I've just conveyed, they're all important. But they are not the fundamental issue. The validity of godless authorities, the reality of future resurrection, the seriousness of God's law, important, but not the fundamental issue. The fundamental issue, Jesus says here, is this. Whose son is the Christ? That's the question he asks in verse 42. Whose son is the Christ? And he goes on to show then that the Christ, the Messiah, cannot ultimately be merely David's son, because David calls the Messiah Lord. David calls him Lord. So the Christ, the Messiah, cannot ultimately be merely David's son. So whose son is he then? Whose son would David possibly address as Lord? Well, Jesus doesn't spell out the answer, but he leads his listeners to conclude the only answer that can really be concluded. He must be God's son. He must be God's son. If David calls the Messiah Lord, then the Messiah must be God's own son. Why is that relevant? What's that got to do with it? Well, it can only be relevant, and Jesus can only close on this note here, because he's presupposing that he is the Christ. I mean, he's already taught that throughout his ministry, and Peter has already confessed that. He's presupposing that he's the Christ, and his point is that if I'm the Christ, then according to Psalm 110, I must also be God's son. And if I'm God's son, then all of you should be down on your knees worshiping me. That's the fundamental issue. Not this point of the Christian worldview and that point of the Christian worldview and that nuance and that principle and that dogma. No, the fundamental issue is this, the identity of Jesus Christ. He is God's son. And if he is God's son, then human beings must bow before him and worship him and surrender their lives to him. That was the fundamental issue for this crowd. And that is the fundamental issue for us too this morning. You see, you may subscribe to all these three points and all other points of the Christian worldview. That may be your worldview. This may be how you look out on the world. You may view the world essentially through the spectacles of the Holy Bible. You may have a biblical Christian worldview. You may agree with the account that the Bible gives of reality, of the world around. But you may still this morning be living for yourself, be living for your own glory, be living to fulfill and please and satisfy your own heart. You may not have surrendered everything at the feet of Jesus Christ and worshipped him as the Son of God. And that's what a Christian is. A Christian isn't someone who can tick all the boxes of the Christian worldview. A Christian is someone who worships Jesus Christ. Worships in the formal sense of sings praises to Jesus Christ as the Son of God. But in the fuller, more far-reaching sense of handing over every part of life,
that you?
That's the question. So I plead with you this morning to recognize the fundamental issue. Jesus is the Son of God. Take that seriously. Respond to that. Cry with Thomas, Jesus, my Lord and my God. Amen. We're going to